Hello, everyone, or howdy, partners, if you prefer, and welcome to episode 133 of Dominaria's Judgment, a mostly weekly, mostly constructed magic podcast. I am Dom Harvey, I'm here with Ari Lax, and we are back here in preview season. That's right, it is once again time for a new dump of magic cards to be heaped upon us here. And after that, only a few short weeks before, Modern Horizons 3, officially overhauls every single format that it is possibly legal in. But for now, we have to focus on what is in front of us, because Pro Tour, Outlaws of Thunder Junction, is just a few weeks away, and we do have to digest the impact of this set on all of the relevant formats before then. So before we begin our Warwind tour here, any general thoughts on the vibe of the set so far? Any kind of big picture takes before we dive into the meat and bones?
So on a card design level, I think this set is very similar to March of the Machine, where I think it was Ben Weitz who posted the, like, for each set, the design that he liked the best and least out of them. And as a result, I went through all the sets. And I think that when I went through March of the Machine, the general vibe I got of the cards was that it was tough to find a worst design. However, it was tough to find a lot of designs I felt uniquely inspiring, because all the cards were just like, oh, that is a cool card that exists in a solitaire vacuum, moving on to the next one. And this set is setting up a lot of the same on that front, where I think that it's just going to be a lot of cards that play pretty well, but I'm going to be hard-pressed in, like, 3 years to talk about more than three of them in a way that I don't think you get with a lot of normal sets. I think that if you talk about Murders at Karlov Manor in 3 years, you will probably have people talking about 10 commons, 10 uncommons, 10 rares in a way that this set won't have. That's my general card-by-card design. I think that might be reflective of my flavor thoughts on this set, and, like, just generally, I don't find the set engaging the more I look at it. I think there's been a lot of good discussion on why, in general. I just want to sum it all up with, I think Tiny Bones would be better if the hat was made of bones, and I think that speaks to a lot of problems that the set has in a single example.
Certainly the timing of the set does not do it any favors, where coming as it does, as I said, just a few months before Modern Horizons 3, where thinking long term, if you look back on this year, this era in 3 or 4 years from now, then I always fear that any design from this set that achieves that escape velocity and does actually have any kind of long-term impact might be misremembered and just folded into the broader impact of MH3 on Modern or Legacy, for example. Unless there are distinct cards which are undeniably from the set, which then make their mark in one of the smaller formats, it might be hard to pinpoint anything that is especially memorable about this one before we move on to the next thing and the next thing. And that's the other issue I think that applies to every set these days, is that the cadence of releases is so fast that there's no real time to dwell on any one thing, and there's always the next thing coming down the pipeline. We already have this backfill of previews for 3 or 4 different sets, which, if we have time, as a stretch goal at the end of this one, we'll get to, or maybe for the next preview episode. But yeah, when you have Assassin's Creed and Fallout stuff over here, and oh, here's a card from Bloomborough, and here's MH3 previews trickling in, and here's actually the set that you think you're looking at, but it's 6 different treatments of all of the mythic rares or whatever. Like, the sheer volume of information is overwhelming enough that no one thing can really get the audience that maybe it deserves. And if I think that the March of the Machine comparison is revealing there, because that set, that was the superhero grand finale culmination of this big story arc, where it was meant to be so chaotic and so cluttered that you had no idea what the overall, like, cohesive nature of the thing was, because that was the point. That was the nature of the thing. Whereas here, it's, yeah, like, notionally, the stakes are a lot lower. Like, this isn't some apocalyptic life or death event for the multiverse. This is just, I don't know, Jace and Vraska just kind of having some fun capers together. It still feels like it's trying to bundle everything in at once. And so this, like, lighthearted Western theme, it's quickly obliterated once it's like, wait, hold on, why is Rakdos here again? And this might be a feature of the Omen Paths era of magic design or magic flavor, where the fact that anyone can be everywhere all at once means that it is easy to lapse into that kind of Oath of the Gatewatch style thing where you just have some of the same characters showing up everywhere, and yet somehow, despite showing up everywhere, you can't really pinpoint anything they did at any of those locations. And also it just makes it even easier for all of those sets to just kind of blur together, where I want to know who are the distinct characters, that like the big cheeses here on this plane. And I don't want to know why Kellen is here and begging for our attention for the fourth consecutive set, or you know, Oko and Rakdos and God knows who else is here. It's like, who are the people who are native to the desert is the wrong word here, but you see what I'm getting at.
Well, first off, they said that there were none of those. And second off, they also basically, by implications of that, declared that the cactus people aren't real people. And in turn, by trying to avoid the exact mess they wanted to avoid, created it. But that's a whole different story, and I don't really want to get into that.
Yeah, we might have to wait for the Final Fantasy Universes Beyond set for the real Kadjar themed set that we've all been yearning for. Although even there, you have the same issue of those are going to be edged out by Yuffie and Tifa just having some kind of feud or something. Like I don't know. It's hard for any one thing to really get the due it deserves these days.
Yeah, I think so. Speaking of that, and your discussion of Final Fantasy reminded me of the Titus laugh indirectly sparking a discussion of this set. But I think that if this set wanted to be sort of a unserious, vaguely thematic, like, memery set, I honestly think that my biggest issue is I think that they could have done with, like, more Blazing Saddles references to really set the tone. Like, the fact that there just hasn't been a card about, like, a shitful of dimes is just really disappointing. If that is the goal of the set, is to just be a giant fiasco mess that is vaguely in a setting.
Yeah, if you're going to do this top-down, like, theme or trope-based design, then lead into it, you know? Actually give us the obvious layout references that you'd expect to see given that.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, the card design is fine. I don't really have issues with any of that stuff, so we can continue on to discussing the cards as opposed to discussing the, like, meta game around the design of the cards.
Yeah, before we do, though, before it all gets lost in the shuffle, I think it's worth touching on some of the miscellaneous news topics from the week real quick here. So we had this organized play update, which was sold initially as discussing the role of arena in future organized play. And so that, to me, I didn't know where to set my expectations there. Like, is this some full-throated return to, like, the hybrid era of paper over here and the paper PC, and then, like, this online track but without the whole, like, scaffolding of the MPL or the shackles that put on it, or is this going to be something just a little more low-key, just moving a few invites and thousands of dollars around? And it seemed like the upshot of it is essentially they've reworked the arena qualifier system to make it a little more intuitive and less high variance, and it actually feels somewhat realistic that you can qualify for some kind of event via arena now, as opposed to the system before, where one or two people would actually make it to the finish line, and then another one or two people would be frantically tagging organized play on Twitter because there's literally no one left in the queue for them to get paid into anymore, and then everyone else is left with, you know, a pat on the back and a few thousand gems and you know, best of luck next time. So it seems like, at least in terms of the arena to paper pipeline, that is a little wider and a little more visible now than it was in the past. So that's good. That said, still really hard to pinpoint where arena fits into OP or to endorse it as this is how you get your foot in the door. Like, if you're someone who you want to get into competitive Magic and you just want to know where to start, I'm not sure your answer to that would involve arena really in any capacity other than getting your occasional, like, $2,000 stimulus from the arena opens.
Yeah, I also generally do not understand the role of this larger arena OP thing, where, like, again, the thing that I liken it to a lot is, like, every other two-day event I have played, when you make day two, you are in the significant prize bracket, and in these, you are just in the, like, garbage. You won the right to play in a PTQ. It's very weird to me. I don't understand, like, what role it is generally serving in the whole ecosystem, like, in general. I don't really know what, like, the day-to-day competitive play on Arena is supposed to look like, is kind of where it starts, like, in a way that on Magic Online, it is very clear, like, what the regular competitive play is supposed to look like, and you are, like, playing challenges or, like, all this other stuff between your, you know, not actually a PGQ-size event runs. And on Arena, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, and there's also a completely farcical illustration of that coming up right now, in fact. So Arena Championship 5 is just around the corner. Could you tell me, off the top of your head, when that event is, who are some of the competitors in it, or where I would go for information about it, or perhaps even to watch it unfold live before my eyes?
Well, I know that one of them is Ethan Sachs, because that was the whole joke where the limited player made their way onto the Pioneer Pro Tour by that method. I feel like I should know at least two other names, because I know at least two to three other players on this. Is one of them... Okay, this is tough. This is a tough one. My assumption is your best bet is to, like, follow the Magic Twitch and then just, like, F5 every Saturday morning and see if it's on.
You could do that. I mean, if you knew when the event was happening, that would reduce the number of times you have to be refreshing the page every so often. It would perhaps shock you and everyone else to learn the event is this weekend, which, if you were following, you know, the official channels on Twitch and elsewhere, if you were logging into the Arena client itself, there's basically no indication that this event exists, or that you, if it did exist hypothetically, that you should even bother to care about it. And I know that the small handful of people who are engaged, whether because they're in there themselves or their friends, their teammates are, they have not been pleased with how these events are marketed, or the lack thereof. So Carl Sarap, for example, pointed out that the Arena Championship Viewers Guide, like the tweet promoting it, they had this whole infographic highlighting the broadcast team, the commentators, the people you're going to see on coverage, but actually finding the identity of the players in the event, the people who those people are meant to be covering, was shockingly difficult for some reason. And so you could read into that some assumption there that, you know, the commentators themselves are the draw and that's why people tune in, which you can go back and forth on that generally. I don't really think that's true of the team selected there, but, you know, you again, not to derail it with that, but it's like, okay, so let's say you are one of those people who you're drawn in because of that, but while we're here, let's try and find something out about the people in question. So the world will not, in fact, know your name. They might know your screen name, and okay, that's one thing. So at least the screen names and how they qualified and you know, the method or whatever. But it's like, okay, so bearing in mind that every previous Arena Championship has also had this same marketing issue and everything else, you're not going to know who any of these people are from their screen name alone. You're more likely, in fact, to know them if they have the same screen name on Magic Online and you saw them in the Mox coverage, or you follow that whole track of competitive play. But there's basically, because there are no Arena tournaments, there is no context in which you could possibly have encountered any of these Arena screen names at any time, unless that's just, again, the same name that they use on literally everything. And so you would think it might be useful to tie those names to their real life names, which, if you were watching the Pro Tour, like the event which there is actually something of a marketing and production push behind, then you could link those up. You could say, okay, the Tangrams that is listed on this competitor's list, oh, that's David Inglis. That's the guy who, whenever I watch the PT, they're always hyping up as the captain of the best team in the world in competitive Magic right now. Okay, that's cool. I get to watch him strut his stuff in this event too. You can link those storylines together. Great. They're not doing that. So unless you follow Tangrams on Twitter because of you saw his exploits there in paper, and you see him tweeting about this event, and he's the one making that connection for you, you're going to have no idea that that's a reason to watch this event. And even if you had refreshed your Twitch page at the right moment to catch Arena Championship 4, unless you are one of those people, you're not going to find Arena Championship 4 to see if there's any continuity between, okay, maybe the defending champion can go back to back. Let's check out this guy. Who is the defending champion? Because they didn't even bother to upload that event or the previous Arena Championships to YouTube. Like, there was basically, unless you go to the Twitch page And then you go to the past broadcast and you like know what to search for or scroll back far enough, there is literally no record that these events ever existed. And so I know there was this interminably annoying debate back in the day of, well, actually, the Pro Tour stands for promotional tour and it's really a marketing expense, and you have to evaluate everything through that lens. And okay, if you do, this is one of the worst uses of a marketing budget that I've ever seen, because they're literally not bothering to market the event at all. So, I mean, say what you will about the nature of the paper Pro Tour or just any given tournament or the larger structure, but at least you can kind of see the internal logic behind even some of the decisions that you might disagree with there. This event, it's just baffling from top to bottom. Like, I don't know why it really exists, who is meant to care other than the people playing in the event, and even how they're meant to care if they want to. Like, I get that, like, some of the other events announced here, there are some streamer showdowns, content creators being invited to compete in these, like, weekly stream 5Ks or whatever. Okay, maybe not for me, but I know it's for someone, and I can kind of form a picture in my head of who it's meant to be for. I don't know who this event is for, either inside the building or outside the building, and it's a mystery.
Yeah, I think the thing you said about, like, not including the prior events, anything in the details of this event, or, like, having it anywhere where it might not just, like, cease to exist because Twitch rolls off your videos one day, that kind of is just really bizarre to me. So the MOCS exists in almost a similar vacuum, but is actually, like, weirdly better marketed, but not in, like, a huge way. But, like, it exists with a very large and rather public qualifying structure around it. And I wonder if the issue here is that the qualifying structure for these events is as large, but not as public.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you ask the average participant in one of these qualifier weekends on Arena, the main prize almost is they get to go to the Pro Tour because they know what the Pro Tour is. The Pro Tour has, unlike the Mythic Championship, it has that decades-long legacy of branding behind it, and it also has that very obvious kind of fulcrum of, oh, this is a thing that you're encouraged to care about from all angles of competitive play, and then, oh, the Arena Championship itself, well, that's cool, and oh, there's actually like a shockingly large amount of money on the line, great, but then again, no one at any level of the system even really knows about the event or tells you to care about it. And so, yeah, I mean, it's hard to be surprised when, in fact, nobody actually cares about it. And so I worry that this almost becomes this self-fulfilling thing where I imagine the viewership numbers, assuming they're real this weekend, will be pretty low, all things considered. And it would be easy to write that off as, oh, well, yeah, people don't care about this event, or people don't want to watch competitive Magic, or they don't want to watch Arena, or whatever level of that you decide to reach a conclusion on. When in reality, is, well, this isn't evidence for anything in particular, because no one is being given a fair shot in any of this. Like, at least give it a fair shake. Like, put on an event. It doesn't even need to award this much money. Like, funnel some of that into marketing the event itself. Make sure people know that it exists, including just the average person who is logging in to complete their daily quests and trying to grind up the ladder on Arena. Make people care, and then see if it's all worth it after all of that shakes out. But right now, it almost feels like to say this event failed or whatever before it's even happened, it's almost a category error, because it's never given the chance to succeed in the first place. Like, what could it be failing at?
Every Arena event has had this exact issue, right? Like, all of the set championships, the MPL Arena splits, everything short of the in-person Arena events that, like, I guess technically got Dave Williams to quit Magic, but besides that, like, those had huge production budgets and were very successful on this front. But, like, every single one that has been, like, digital-only people at home has failed in ways that it feels like the MOCS kind of hasn't. And maybe some of that is just literally the Randy Buehler, or was it Randy who made the spreadsheets, where it's just like, these are the player's stats in every format, how many thousands of matches they played, why one of them, like, only watches Demir Mill replays instead of movies, and has no favorite movie, and things like that. You know, I think that is what might be the issue slash what's missing.
Yeah, the Mox is a great comparison point, because that also it's going to be hard to drum up a general level of interest in that, I think. But they at least give it a crack, right? Like that spreadsheet, they do their best with it. And I don't know exactly what the structure is behind it, where I know Anurag does a lot of the production stuff, but it feels like more of an external operation. But this should be like the capstone in the organized play calendar. Like, you, once the PT ends and you know that the next PT is coming down the pipeline, like, this should be the thing in between, which has pride of place on your calendar. And instead, it's just an afterthought, even for the people who are meant to be jazzing you up and getting you excited about it. So I don't know. The NPL stuff was almost all glitz and no substance, where, like, yeah, this isn't an esport, and you can't tell us that it's an esport with, you know, bright lights and loud sounds. Like, the underlying product has to be watchable in a way that it wasn't, but you can at least do the best with the product that you have. And this almost, again, it's really phoning it in.
I guess to say all of this, we haven't talked about the good part of the announcement, which is that the Pro Tour is, like, actually going back to Pro Tour sizes and not randomly capped at low amounts, which I guess randomly is probably the wrong word to use, because it was probably reasonably capped at low amounts because they were uncertain about what the convention physical space would look like in, you know, 2022. But now that they have a year or two of experience under their belt, they can go into 2024 and say, oh yeah, like, this all is cool and makes sense.
Yeah, I do defer to the people who were regulars in the larger PTs before and said that, yeah, that the vibe just feels like a little bit different when it's 200, 250 instead of 350, 400. And part of that's for the better, part of it for the worse, but it's something that is different in a way that maybe is hard to articulate. I think, though, that what a lot of those people actually miss is not just specific people, but like a certain class of competitor that used to be in that, like, missing 100, missing 150 people. And that's the same band of players that was mostly cut out by the NPL system, right? It's the people who were often gold, like, sometimes platinum if they had a good year. The kind of people who, you know, maybe they have, like, exactly one PT top eight to their name, or they're the guy who it seems like they're coming just so close every time. You know they're going to get their breakout finish pretty soon, but it's only a matter of time. And when it finally does, you're not surprised, but you're really happy for them. And those are the people who a lot of them just, like, fell off, and some of them are making a valiant attempt to get back on, but a lot of them have just moved on completely to other things. And I think that a lot of the best of the best are still around, so, like, you can still be in a pod on day one with, like, Reed and Kai and Nathan and Javier and so on, and it's like, okay, well, yeah, this is the big leagues. But it's the people who, if they're the best player in your pod, like, maybe you breathe a sigh of relief, but you know that when you get paired against them, they're going to make you really work for it. Like, those people in between, where, you know, if your PT experience is, well, yeah, I played against Reed and he demolished me, but then my other 15 rounds were against, like, other random RCQ or RC winners. Okay, that's one thing. But if it's, yeah, I played against Reed, but I also played against, like, Matt Nass over here and Steve Rubin and some guy from Europe who I don't know exactly what he's top eighted, but I know he's top eighted a lot of things. And, like, you feel like you're in the murderer's row at that point. Whereas I think when there is, like, this gap between the people at the top and the people at the bottom, if you just make that second group even bigger, then it might just increase that sense of alienation rather than healing it.
Well, I guess my first thought is that the person you're describing is exactly Christian Calcano, which is very funny because he's also a success story of the new Pro Tour. But my follow-up question is, are you actually generating those people by adding another 100 people to the Pro Tour each time? I don't actually know if this system is doing that, because I don't know if that person who top-aided things that you feel like you should know about, I don't know if you actually should know about them right now.
Yes, and this was always its own marketing failure before, right? Of the secret gold or secret platinum players who, if you were in the know, then you knew to be scared of them, but the average person on the PT who, because they weren't in the know, should be scared. Like, they weren't in the know for good reason. It's not like they weren't paying attention. It's just that they were given no reason to care about those people, like the Kevin Pastors of the world, right? Whoever those people are in whatever system, you need to find a way to kind of get the word out there, if you like. You know, they're not doing that now, but they weren't really doing that before. maybe some of it is just a passage of time, right? Maybe you need to give it a few years for this new class of those almost elite players to make a name for themselves, and then the people who are not at that level yet facing them for the first time will start to feel those emotions again.
Yeah, again, I don't know if this system generates those, but I do think that this is a good step forward for the Pro Tour. I don't think this is a bad thing in any way.
Oh, no, I'm excited for it, for sure.
It makes the level below the Pro Tour a better tournament to actually be interested in playing, which is a pretty big step forward.
Yeah, maybe this is the thing that GPs did uniquely that the RCs haven't managed to do yet, which is I feel like there are a lot of people who were crushing the GP circuit, and then maybe it took a while for that to carry over to the PT, but you felt like, okay, they're setting themselves up for success, and I know them from like this one avenue, and I'm excited to follow their success in this one. Whereas the RCs, if they're even streamed at all, which is the case for what, like three or four of them, or you know, you have to know exactly where to go on specifically this Chinese viewing site to see the Chinese RC or something, like that's a lot easier said than done a lot of the time. And then even when you do, it's, well, there's three or four RCs a year instead of 25, 30 GPs. And so there's no chance of someone to go on some like Matt Nassian streak with KCR or something, because like, where are they going to do that?
Well, I mean, there are 25 RCs a year. They're just, you're not allowed to play in more than three of them. And by you, I mean any given person. And that is part of the problem there. You don't generate a person who top eights six RCs a year.
Yes, that might be a fun place for the Magic storyline to go, is Matt Nass donning like a trench coat and a suspicious European accent to try and like smuggle himself into a European RC or something. But barring that, in terms of what you're legally allowed to do in the system, it's hard to make a name for yourself without like spiking an RC, which again, people might not even remember you for, and then also spiking the PT that you qualified for, and maybe then people sit up and take notice. But that's a tall order.
Yeah, a great side topic about things you're legally allowed to do, as we have a wonderful case of cheating being caught on camera by someone who cheated before the pandemic and was removed from the DCI and then came off a suspend and is probably just going to go right back into the abyss.
Yeah, see, now there's nothing to be removed from or no list to be added to. He is just a person like you and me who exists out there in the ether, and so it is really hard to keep track of past crimes that have been committed in these tournaments. And so, yeah, you're going to see a lot more cases like this of, in this case, someone who is both brazen and stupid enough to get caught doing this repeatedly. But there will be people who, I don't know, they cheated in the past, they got caught, and now they've come back and they've wised up in their methodology, if not their ethics, and now they're just not getting caught. And that's a disaster. Or the people who, you know, that they're cheaters, and in a sane system that like bothered to log these things, they would be enjoying an extended vacation from competitive Magic. But no, that doesn't exist, so they're back. And I mean, in some cases, you have people who were like banned for 3 years or whatever, and that eventually expired because God knows how long the pandemic lasted in totality, and is still lasting for. And so, yeah, like, okay, they're back too. And so you have all of these different groups of convicted felons battling out to see who can be, the king of crimes.
Yeah, I am generally a fan of the old system's ability to say, like, okay, this person has come back and, like, they've been given some time off, maybe things are different, and then we'll ban them again. But I think that because like anyone who was banned in 2018 basically served like a fractional sentence, it may just be best to like assume that they're still cheating, unfortunately. Even though, again, there are a lot of people who have been success stories of Magic who have been banned for various degrees of cheating, as severe, like all the way up to, they have accumulated so many instances of being assumed to be cheating, but have not been like hardcore caught, and we're just going to tell them to leave for a while. That's a whole story of its own. But
yes, for another time maybe, because we have other crimes to talk about and a lot of Magic cards to talk about. So let's dive in there. And we spoke a little bit about the general vibe of the set, some of the flavor and creative stuff. Let's talk about the mechanics here, and let's start with the crime mechanic, or I guess mechanic is not the word. It's more just a way of batching certain game actions, in this case, all of them. And this one is very commander coded. This is no discard, no LED, no LD. Just don't perceive me in any way, please.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting batching. I think that the thing that I will have to play with it some, but the things that I sort of see coming out of it are basically, one, I think a lot of cards where they say whenever you, like, do a crime, the problem you're going to run into is that is whenever you profitably cast a spell in the first place. So I think that you're creating a lot of win more scenarios with a lot of the cards we'll talk about. I don't know, someone brought up the Legends card, Eater of the Dead, which is a 4 and a black, 3/4 with, like, 0 exile target card in a graveyard, which you can just stack on itself infinite times and make infinite crimes and, like, just complete nonsensical stuff. But, like, I think that is largely the two extremes of the format. I don't even think Devoted Druids is necessarily, like, it doesn't have to be infinite, but you're trying to, like, generate a Rube Goldberg contraption of ways to commit a crime via normal game actions as opposed to investing a card in it. So I think that's an important part of evaluating the mechanic in general. So to highlight one card that I think might fall into this camp, there is the Hard Bristle Bandit. This is the 1 in a green, 1/1 with tap, add a mana of any color, and it untaps the first time you commit a crime each turn. I think that the mana burst on that card is, like, sort of weirdly tied to, like, the game already being profitable for you, in a way that I'm not a huge fan of. I will say I don't necessarily feel the same about, and it may be a difference of that card versus Mogda the Horde Master. This is 1 in a red, 2/2. Whenever you commit a crime for the first time each turn, make a tap treasure, and then you can sack 3 treasures to make a 4, like a Volcanic Dragon, effectively 4/4 Flying Haste Scorpion Dragon. With that card, I think that there's a context of, like, when you are talking about, like, how am I targeting my opponent's stuff, and it's like, okay, well, they have to have, like, put a card in their graveyard, which isn't, like, I'm relying on them, like, playing a creature or, like, doing something that isn't necessarily true about the game state. Whereas with Mogda, it's just like, I don't know, I'm just gonna lava spike them, and we'll just make a treasure when I lava spike them. This, if you have card A and card B, you've effectively created the engine. And also, like, are the things that you are doing to trigger this agnostic of what your opponent is playing? I think that those are the things to watch for here.
Yeah, I know people have said that the definition of what counts as a crime feels almost comically wide, and people have made the obvious jokes about how all of these various different things are crimes, but, like, the actual card named Larceny, just because of the way it does its thing, like, that doesn't count as a crime. So, I mean, there's always going to be edge cases to chew over, but I think that I like almost including effectively everything like this, because if you didn't, then instead of those edge cases being like these funny but obscure things that won't come up, it gets moved to, well, why this thing and not that thing, and if the line being drawn there feels counterintuitive, then that's something which just pervades every format that this mechanic shows up into to any degree. So I like erring on the side of, yeah, if in doubt, that's a crime. Don't do it. Be careful. As opposed to the reverse. I guess the thing which is more subtle about it, and this could then turn into something that is negative or at least a nuisance, is some stuff is very obvious, right? Like, if I cut down your creature, well, that's aggravated manslaughter. I have committed a crime. Clap me in irons. Whereas if I activate my unlicensed hearse targeting cards in your graveyard, I know when I activate my hearse or when I put that card in my deck or I sideboard it in that I am being hateful towards you, but that consists of, you know, the fact that those cards are being exiled continuously and you're not getting to do your fun thing with them, as opposed to the technical definition that I have targeted cards in your graveyard. And so one example of where this would come up would be with, like, Edict effects, right? So phenomenally flexible removal spell, but the way it's worded, it's a boon in formats like Legacy, for example, where you can't Veil of Summer to give yourself protection from an opponent's Shieldred's Edict, but in the context of committing a crime, like, oh, it technically doesn't actually satisfy any of the conditions, but it's not obvious why that card would, and just something that says target opponent sacrifices a planeswalker they control, you code those cards as they're doing the same thing, effectively. And so the fact that you're looking at this like very legalistic difference, I guess flavorfully it kind of makes sense, but I wonder if stuff like that is going to cause some teething pains with the mechanic early on.
Yeah, I mean early, but I don't think it'll be that bad. I mean, like, Old Gaspark isn't a historic permanent or whatever, or like, I don't think this is any worse than like trying to remember which of your creatures is an outlaw, which I think is independently and like, it's not the same thing as a party. It, like, the outlaw thing, they're all the same, which is, I don't want to conflate those two. But anyways, I don't think this is any different from any other batching situation. And it provides a lot of, I think it provides a lot of new context in a way, again, going to like historic or outlaw or things like that. I think that the fact that it is redefining a game action, I like better than redefining trinket text or card types. Just because it feels like it is, there are more novel things you can do with the mechanic.
Yeah, and I think that this naturally forces you to think about timing and sequencing decisions and, you know, do I use my instant speed removal spell on my opponent's turn to use my mana efficiently, or do I save it for my own turn where I want to be committing a crime in that exact window and this is the most obvious way for me to do it? And I guess some amount of that is baked into just naturally anything that triggers, like, when you cast a spell, right? Do I save my removal spell for my turn so I get a prowess trigger on top? So that kind of stuff is pretty universal, but I think that in practice, yeah, it's going to be at worst a harmless mechanic, and ideally will be a pretty fun one to play with. And I think the card that is most likely to feature this in competitive play across various settings here is notable criminal himself, Nathan Stoyer, whose 2022 World Championship Invitational card is finally coming to us in this set. So let's talk about Duelist of the Mind. This is one in a blue for a star 3 flyer with flying and vigilance. Its power is equal to the number of cards you've drawn this turn, and whenever you commit a crime, you may draw a card. If you do, discard a card, and this triggers only once each turn. So notably, it only triggers once each turn, so if you trigger it and decline, you can't then commit a crime again and then trigger it in that same turn cycle. You've had your shot and you've turned it down. But generally, this is going to be in the same mold as like Ledger Shredder is an obvious comparison, but...
Yeah, so this card specifically I have a lot of thoughts on, because... So it's kind of like the reverse of Ledger Shredder in a lot of ways. I think that one of the things that Ledger Shredder does really well is that it is a reasonable defensive body while chipping away. And this card is just like a horrific defensive body because it's an 0-3 on most of your opponent's turns. So you're like decidedly supposed to be attacking with this creature despite the fact that it has vigilance. I think that the other sort of interesting thing that inverts it relative to Ledger Shredder is it's producing the most power output when you are drawing the maximum number of cards in a given turn, which, and also it rewards you from only like the first spell you're casting each turn, which in turn makes you want to play it with clunkier cards and like bigger bursty card draw engines to maximize those in a way that Shredder is sort of like accumulating advantage over smaller plays over a longer amount of time. That all said, this is in the spots where you're like, I'm going to fiery impulse your creature to commit a crime to loot. This card is just bananas in those, because it's just like, okay, I'm going to kill your first thing, and this is drawing me into my thing that kills your next thing. I think in raw application, it's probably going to come up behind a Shredder in older formats, just because it feels like Shredder, the more linear, or the more streamlined the format is, the more likely the fact that Ledger Shredder triggers off both players comes up a lot. I am sort of interested in this in the like Prof's Eidetic Memory deck. Both sort of condense the deck into necessarily not needing to be Dimir, allowing it to branch into other colors by having a lot of similar payoffs in blue alone, but also letting the deck bring the curve down and look slightly different than the traditional Dimir deck does, where I feel like right now one of the issues with that deck, it is a Dimir deck that has this engine, but also suddenly becomes like a weirdly more sorcery deck that also dies more to Shouldred than Dimir. And I think that this might let it diversify a little bit more.
Yeah, that broad archetype has been floating around on Magic Online, and it's been fun to see how the lists have kind of mutated and tried a bunch of these obscure cards, which, like, there are so many good twos and threes in standard right now that left your own devices, these aren't making it into your stock Dominion deck over like Deep Cavern Bat or whatever. But when you have this very specific incentive, then yeah, you dust off your Evangel of Synthesis or whatever and you get to work. And so yeah, I am intrigued by that shell, and I think Nathan's card is a perfect card for it. The Ledger Shredder comparison, I think it's... There will be decks that try to pair these cards together, so you know that deck is the perfect example. And so finding the crossover there, I think it's a good exercise to kind of illuminate where they're similar and where they're different. So the cheap removal spells, right? You know, Fiery Impulse and Pioneer, Cut Down would be the go-to one in standard, Duress as well, like the fact that you duress them, you commit a crime, and then your duress resolves. Hopefully you clear the way for your next thing. Like, that's going to be a really powerful sequence in standard. Like, the cheap, specifically interactive cards pair very well with both. And then there's this weird asterisk there with a card like Spell Pierce, or really any reactive card, where you... Like, Nathan's card almost pushes you towards doing exactly one thing on your turn and holding up mana so that you can then interact with the one big thing that they're doing on their turn. And Shredder wants the exact opposite. It wants you to either cluster your actions on your turn, or for them to take several actions on their turn, or for you to take several actions on their turn. And so there, the incentives just go completely haywire. But and then also with a card like Shredder, like, it just wants you to be doing stuff. It doesn't really care what it is, as long as you can do a lot of it. And so that's why in like Pioneer Phoenix, for example, Shredder's so perfect there, because you can be spinning your tires with Opt and Sleight of Hand or Consider, and somewhere in there, you just get this free bonus on the house from Shredder. Where Nathan does actually want you to be perceiving the opponent in some way, which I think is a healthier incentive overall versus the very like solipsistic, oh, I cast Consider and then tank on my Sleight of Hand for 30 seconds and then just resolve my Treasure Cruise or something. Like, with Duelist, there is inherently more back and forth, and I like that. And so when it comes to choosing one or the other, or pairing them together, like, yeah, that Profs deck in standard, I think, is a good shell for both cards, but how you balance that is interesting. And then in something like Pioneer Phoenix, which, like, that deck is a candidate for this card, but I think it might encourage you to build the deck in a different way, where, like, the play pattern of turn three, Cosmo Shredder, Cosmo Cantrip, and Connive, you actually do have to work meaningfully harder for that with this card. So, yeah, Shredder's still going to be the default there. Maybe there's some different list of Phoenix, or just different deck together. I mean, you can build a Profs deck in that format too. I could see there being decks where you start with like four Shredder, four Duelists, and fill it out from there. But seeing how those incentives do or don't match up is a good exercise, I think.
Yeah, I will mention that this card is absolutely cracked with Steam Core Scholar.
Yes.
Yeah, that interaction is pretty awesome.
Pretty nice with Rafine as well, as it turns out, as most creatures that attack tend to be. As you said, the Vigilance here is weird in that very often this is going to be just a weird flying wall on the opponent's turn, and not weird in the Steam Core Scholar tribal sense, but like, it's bizarre. That said, maybe this is where those cards like Consider come into play, right? Where if you have a cheap way to make sure that you're drawing a card on the opponent's turn, then it starts to maybe be... It's almost like a weird combat trick. It starts to be a threatening blocker. So finding ways to kind of go against one incentive to power up some other part of the card, that's an interesting puzzle to wrestle with as well.
Yeah, it is an interesting card. I am not immediately hopeful for its prospects in the same way that I feel like it feels like a less flashy card than Fairy Mastermind, but at the same time, like, that's fine. This is like a totally fine range for these cards to fall in. Better than Fervent Champion is a totally low bar to clear, and this clears it. Offense, but that card, whew.
I mean, Javier has decent odds of winning Worlds again at some point, so he'll get a second bite at the apple, maybe. But yeah, I know Yuta, who... Fairy Mastermind has finally seen its time in the sun in standard, so I'm glad he's got to experience that. But I know that as soon as Nathan's card was spoiled, he was like... This almost feels like a slap in the face, because Nathan lines up so well against Yuta that maybe he himself has been obsolete now. That said, I mean, the... Just being a reasonably big, cheap flyer is more relevant in this standard format than in basically any other one, because there are so many good cheap flyers like Deep Cavern Bat, Muta, Malcolm might just be effectively illegal now in a world of Nathans and so on. Like, the fact that you get like a decent hit in, and then this is a good blocker on defense. It is good against all of the even smaller flyers out there, but also we're going to talk about the fast lands and how the aggro decks as a class got a pretty big buff with this set, even before you know any of the spells that have been printed. Yeah, having this thing which can play offense and defense and, like, is your three toughness is nothing to shrug at. Like, okay, that contextually, that's actually pretty important too.
Yeah, scanning through the other cards that have crime on them, I'm not super impressed with most of them on the aspect of the crime stuff. I could see Free Strider Lookout being, like, that is the card where if you are setting up some kind of, like, zero to activate engine, that card seems exceptionally powerful. This is the 2 in a green, 3/3 reach that whenever you commit a crime, you look at the top 5 cards of your deck, put a land, not necessarily a basic even, just a land into play tapped, and put the rest on the bottom. And it feels like if you just have that card with a card that you can just, like, crime on each turn, because it's, you know, once per turn or whatever, but, like, you just go off in a way that none of the other cards really does. Like, the next closest might be, like, I don't know, Gisa or At Knife Point, which are the ones that generate creature tokens, and even that is kind of... It feels like a different class of value where it's like, I don't, you know, if I played a 3-drop enchantment or like a 5-drop creature, I like almost expect them to be a like pseudo Grave Titan these days. I don't know why I need to go through the extra step.
Yeah, and this will prompt people to do the kind of very specific Scryfall search that you never would have done before, where, okay, I don't really care about what you're doing, I care about whether you're targeting something in the process. And so, yeah, a card like Unlicensed Hearse, for example, suddenly looks a lot more versatile than it has in the past, because even if you don't give a shit about the cards being exiled from their graveyard, the mere fact that you are activating for free at instant speed every turn cycle in a way that commits a crime, well, that suddenly gets a card across the line in matchups where you would never even consider it before.
Yeah, notably with that one, you might be able to start like under criming where it's up to 2 cards and you're like, okay, I'll exile one of your cards now, we're saving the other one for later.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of at first quite counterintuitive patterns around that, that, you know, if you figure those out in the very short time before, you know, between the set becoming legal and the standard Pro Tour that's happening in less than a month, oh dear God, then that's a way to get a nice edge on the competition there. And also, just even in, like, if some of these cards do make their way to standard, doing the scan and open deck list for, okay, well, I could tell you the text on this card, but actually having the wherewithal to realize, oh, this is a thing that commits a crime. Like, you don't want to be learning for the first time that, oh, I ran my spell into a spell pierce, and, oh, wait, they're Nathan triggered for some reason?
Yes, that's very true. I do want to highlight one fun little aspect of the crime mechanic, which is that Oko is one of the crime-specific cards, yet somehow none of the 4 abilities on the card commit a crime.
That feels like a very Oko thing. Now, that's very Oko-coded.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed that. I'm just, you know, I want to put that out there into the world, and we'll get back to that card later. Yes. Anything else on crimes before the next mechanic?
No, let's move on to mount. So this is the idea behind vehicles transported over to creatures. This is an easy ace, in my view. It almost makes you wonder what took so long to make this happen. Also makes you wonder what mechanics like Enlist could have been, where it felt like it gestured in this general direction and yet just flopped horribly as a result.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mind Enlist. I like the fact that it deals with power a bit more than, like, the mount ability kind of, I don't really know, just, like, arbitrarily existing. I don't really get the vibe from mount that I'm intended to be activating it often or at all across, like, the competitive span of the format. It feels like the kind of thing that is, like, intended to be you play this card in limited and then your next creature, I don't know, activates this every turn. Like, you played a 4/4 the next turn and then this does that. I think the most powerful saddle card that's been previewed is the Legendary Unicorn. Let me see if the actual translated name has gone up, but this is the green-white 2/2 lifelink first strike saddle 4, and if it's mounted, whenever it attacks, create a 3/3 angel. It's like, okay, so I'm going to play this into, like, my, you know, Lovestruck Beast equivalent on 3, and then I guess if both of these things live, I make an angel, but, like, also the world where my 2-drop into 3-drop curve happens, do I need that extra extra edge? And like, would I rather just have a better 2-drop? I don't know. That's kind of my struggle with even the best of these.
Yeah, I think with vehicles, it took them a while, just like it did with the first batch of equipment as well, to actually tweak the dials and calibrate those exactly how they wanted to. And so, yeah, with Smuggler's Copter, for example, or Renegade Freighter in Limited, you get the numbers off by a little bit here or there, and suddenly you have a card which is just way too powerful for its context. I wonder if some amount of that is possible with mount as well, although the fact that, first of all, this isn't meant to be an evergreen thing the way the vehicles are, and so it would not shock me if they brought mount back again. It's a very obvious thing to do. If you need to fill a hole in a file, it's a good thing to go back to, but this is not going to be the second coming of vehicles, and so there's almost no need to make your mistakes the first time around because it's one and done. And then also, because it's tied to creatures, you already have this, this decades-long wealth of experience of how do we want to size creatures appropriately for them to actually accomplish their goals. And so, yeah, I think you're not going to see the same level of balance issues that you had with vehicles at first. So no Smuggler's Copter-style mount thing, I imagine. I was partial to the 2 and a green mount thing, which has the Luminarch aspirant text, but then when it attacks also doubles the number of counters on something. That's going to be a fun card to play with, although has the same cut down issues or whatever that all cards like that have had for standard. And then the play pattern with vehicles, where they really encourage offense first and foremost, and in a way which, if you let's use Copter as an example, you pass the turn open holding up your removal spell, they just play Copter instead. Okay, you've wasted mana that turn cycle, and then maybe you pass again on a future turn to try and catch the Copter with removal before it attacks, and they sniff that out, and instead they just play some other threat instead, and then now you've wasted another chance to use your removal spell properly. That cat and mouse game doesn't really exist here. If you want to kill the mount thing, you just get it dead and then you move on with your life.
Yeah, I think that is a categorical problem with these designs. I don't want to say problem with the designs, but a mechanical consideration for playing with them that just doesn't exist for the two card types you listed that are artifacts. And it was sort of one of the problems with Enlist, which is just if the Enlist thing is scary, it just died. Which I think we can talk a little bit about the Gitrog Monsters card in this set, where it is a saddle creature. But I think that the real thing it has to offer is that it's just a 6/5 trample haste for 5.
Yes, and maybe we're going to see less horny posting about Thalia now that it seems like she is officially inside the Gitrog monster.
Sure, yes, you can believe that. Magic players will have an absolutely normal one with that, and we will not discuss it any further.
Yes, instead, we will discuss plot. Okay, plots, yes. So, plots. Thoughts on plots, Ari?
The mechanic, I think, is really interesting and potentially very powerful. I think that there is an interesting balancing act with a lot of these cards in, this was the intent to suspend, where they're you sacrifice early development for later payoff. And with suspend, it was just I just paid 2 mana for a 4/4 flying creature. This is busted. I get so much more payoff. It's not really even a consideration. And with these cards, I think the interesting thing that plot does is that this decision is being made, at the time that you would cast the card normally. So it's not you're changing the time frame of taking the initial action. You're just changing, do I take X now or X plus a little bit later? And I think that's really good and interesting. There is actually a card that I think literally as we're talking about this may have been previewed because I hadn't seen it before, that I think really illustrates this well. And this is Outcaster Trailblazer. It's 2 and a green for a 4/2 ETB, add a mana of any color, and whenever another creature with power 4 or greater ETBs, draw a card and has plot 2 and a green. And I think that the fact that this card can, exist as, a micro Burning Tree Emissary, where, you play this on 4 and then also cast another, a 2-drop, or you plot it on 3 and then you cast it on 4 and then, play your 5-drop with it. But then there's also, am I plotting this and losing an attack with my 4-power creature because of it? A lot of very interesting things going on there with what am I supposed to do in a given game with this design? And a lot of good design space in terms of payoff. So yeah, big fan of this mechanic. Really good. We'll talk. Let's just leave the Jace discussion again for a little bit, the same way we left the Oko discussion. Are there any non-Jace designs that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'm just reading that card, as you mentioned it, but I'm already in love with it. It's amazing that they found a way to make mana ramp of that style, like, novel, even after God knows how long of doing it, but they found a way and tied it into that mechanic very well. So yeah, that card is a home run, I think. There was also, I think, the plot card that is most likely to, almost priced to move in Constructed is the 2-drop. The one in red, say this 5 times fast, Slick Shot Show Off, that is one in a red, flying haste. When you play a non-creature spell, it gets +2/+0, and it has a plot one in a red as well. And so I think the first reaction to this card for a lot of people was confusion. It's, well, why does this need plot? When are you ever going to plot this? But answering that question is, I think, part of what makes this mechanic interesting. Because if it was obvious when you're meant to do that or why, then that takes away a lot of the fun and the tension around it. Whereas here, yeah, you can play this in the average red deck where you just play it straight up on turn two every time as intended, or later whenever you draw it. But also, if you find a reason to, you know, cast multiple spells in the same turn, like this can be the first spell if you want to delay it that long. Or, for example, someone mentioned the curve of plotting this on turn two, and then turn three you cast this and you cast Godric or any other celebration thing, and you immediately get the celebration bonus. So there's a lot of tying into other mechanics, even if the obvious use maybe doesn't add up, and that's a good plot, right? You want to have some layers to it.
Yeah, and this card does have haste to like offset that like plot and then like lose the attack with the creature. I'm like kind of interested in the other red 2-drop, which is the Crafty Coyote, the one in a red. I think it has haste, and then ETB gives a creature +1/+1 in haste until EOT and has plot one in a red. As a longtime Lightning Mauler enjoyer, I just like immediately look at this card and I'm like, okay, is this the red 2-drop I'm looking for? I don't think it is, because I think that we're kind of in an era of red creatures where like it is a very big struggle to put ones without haste in your deck, but it's on the table for future formats as thing of all.
Yeah, and it's also not obvious these days what a good sizing for an aggro red creature is, where there are so many things which have really high toughness, and or it's conditional high toughness, or and so the fact that you, yeah, if this is just a 2/2 with haste, as so many other creatures are, like Felden, Bloodthirsty Adversary, whatever, like that stat line is not that impressive, but given that this can be so much more, like this can enable a big attack with one thing that would have been brickwalled otherwise. And so yeah, there is dynamic math there to be done in combat, and there's not much more you can ask for from like a, you know, just a random 2-drop with a set mechanic on it.
Yeah, I like that card. Like, this is one of the stylistically, I think, fun cards of the set, is the Coyote Roadrunner thing. I don't know. Those two are just kind of like a smash hit. Big fan of those. Favorite designs of the set by, I think, a large margin. There is also the plot Time Spiral, or Time Twister. I guess it's a bit of both. Wander Between Worlds is 3 blue-blue... Time Twister, exile this card, and then plot 4 blue-blue, so it's a Time Spiral if you do that. I don't think that this is actually priced to function in Constructed. You know, like, I don't think most combo decks are going to operate under this, like, make 6 mana on a turn to spend 1 to kill you. But it is, like, an interestingly and uniquely powerful card that I expect to see pop up in Cube a decent amount.
Time Reversal, if you will. I think any Time Twister effect naturally catches your eye, even though if you're seeing it at all in a standard card file, it usually means there's enough safeguards built in that actually the danger that's there isn't really present. One card that is at least intriguing, even if it might flop in the same way, Make Your Luck. So this is the Simic 5-drop where you look at the top three, you plot one of them, and then you put the other two into your hand. So this... Your mind immediately jumps to visions of, well, I play this, and then next turn, like, I get a free Atraxa, I get a free Atali, I get other stuff. I worry that if you try to model this as, like, some unexpected results style card, then you end up with a deck that just doesn't really function when you don't draw this card, and maybe even when you do, because it's only three cards that you're looking at here, right? That's not a high number, and so you either need to rig the top of your deck in some way, ideally using actual cards and not like literal sleight of hand, or you need to have so many big hits in your deck that even with only three cards, you're more likely than not to find one of them. And I think the math there just doesn't really work out. I guess if a sweeper or something qualifies sometimes, and that moves it a bit, but that's exactly the kind of card which you don't want to be face up waiting for the following turn. So I think that what you're really looking for here is a card which are expensive when actually hard cast, but have some kind of useful buyout clause. So Magma Opus historically comes to mind, or Herd Migration, right? Like, let's say your standard domain deck, maybe it looks very different from the current builds, but based on that premise, you know, you cast Make Your Luck, you hit Herd Migration, and then two other things, and the next thing you just get a free Herd Migration, and that can be that plus, you know, some number of attractors still, whatever, that can be your top end that just kind of goes over the top of anything, you know, sane and rational. But also, even if you miss, sometimes you cast this on turn four, turn five, you trigger your Beanstalk, you draw two cards outright, and you plot your next thing. Like, it could be another Make Your Luck for next turn, and okay, you felt like you've used your mana well, even though you didn't officially hit Yahtzee.
Yeah, I think this card is just cracked. I think this card is busted. You know all those spots where the whole point of the game is making sure that your blue opponent can't cast Memory Deluge on turn four, otherwise you die, because they've taken the turn, like, they've had a free turn to cast the card drop spell and set up. You are setting up where you're like, I need my opponent to not be able to tap out safely for this on five, because if they do, I just lose the game on the spot. This card's really absurd.
Yeah, this is giving some kind of like Escape to the Wilds vibes. Notably, Memory Deluge, not a good card to plot with this or with anything else, really. But one kind of card that actually is stuff like, you know, Bramble Familiar, as, you know, if you remember the brief like Invasion of Alara Fever Dream with that card, then that's actually like a really nice card to hit with this. Virtue of Persistence, same deal. Or really any of the expensive adventures which also have a good thing you can just do on turn two. So cards like that are just in abundance in Standard right now. And yeah, I mean, this works very nicely with those, or really with most other things. I think this is a good card to start building your deck around, and it pays you off for doing that.
Yeah, and I guess maybe we can start by talking about this now. Everyone's big deal is trying to plot Valky/Tybalt. I think that something you've pointed to is like this idea that if you have this big, dumb, expensive card you're trying to plot, you kind of want it to be a card that you want to draw and like handle normally. And that card does, I don't think it crosses the line. I also have been increasingly unimpressed with the Tybalt side of the card. Like, it has rapidly declined in quality as, so it was very good around call time to do this, but it was because it was in such a short, condensed time frame that you generated the card. Like, it was turn two or turn three in Modern. I think the problem that has arisen is that design in the post-War of the Spark era has actively been hostile to Planeswalkers, but it's because every card is a Planeswalker that you can't attack. Like, there's no reason to produce a Planeswalker that can be attacked and just, like, dies if your opponent has tangible value laying around. If you can just create a card that has tangible value and only dies if they point a removal spell directly at it. So Tybalt just kind of fails in a lot of those cases. And so I would much rather just try and do something with a normal card, or like you said, like whatever the Bramble Familiar equivalent is. So anyways, we'll get to that a little bit later, but I just wanted to bring that up here in the discussion of plot, because that card being plottable for like all the cards that are like whatever mana value or less and then castable as Tybalt, at least we think so, is a big part of what people are talking about right now.
Yeah, there is a massive difference between, I mean, obviously the Cascade into Valky experience, we're all scarred from that to some degree, but using the more fair comparison of Bring to Life of Valky, which still a pretty powerful tactic you can do in Pioneer, I think that has got markedly worse to the point where, to me, that used to be a big reason to play these four color, five color Bring to Light soup decks, whereas now it's just one more cool thing you can do with those, but it's not an active reason to embrace them for some of the reasons that you described. And that is spending five mana with one card to achieve that outcome in a way where if you then hit further bring to lights off your Valkyrie, you're very happy about it. Whereas these whole setups where, okay, I'm going to use my Jace, this new Jace, and I'm going to plot my Valkyrie, and then, oh, if I have Leyline of Anticipation in the mix, well, I can do this all a turn sooner. Well, okay, you've now spent three cards to produce your one Valkyrie, which, when it plus ones, is flipping over a lot of Leyline of Anticipations and Jaces and future Valkyries. Like, that's really not the same. You know, just getting Valkyrie into play, even if it survives for several turns, is not the game winner that it used to be. And so, yeah, I think that I'm excited to watch others trying to do that and having fun with it. But that's not, we're not back in Valkyrie summer, Valkyrie winter, whatever it is in your part of the world.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about with plot before we move along to? I think there's one more mechanic in the set.
Yes, so that is Spree, which I know the joke is every mechanic is a variant on Kicker to some degree. This very much is some kind of entwine coded Kicker adjacent cleave ish kind of card or mechanic, and it's fine, I suppose. I've had this issue. I don't know if this is just a skill issue on my part, but when reading these cards, I really struggle to pass them because I'm so used to thinking of, you have this baseline cast, and then you have this additional cast. Whereas here, you have, I guess, a sub-baseline cast, and then you have to pay an additional cost whatever you do. And so I find myself thinking, oh, cool, I get this effect for 2 mana. And it's, no, actually, you get this effect for 3 mana. And then if you want something else on the menu, you then have to pay the additional tip on top of that. And so, you know, my expectations management with these cards has not been good so far. Some individual examples have caught my eye, but once I get over just my own illiteracy, I'll maybe have a more fair and balanced view here.
I'm shocked you didn't come in here with a, like, the top right of the card doesn't mean anything anymore rant on these.
Well, I mean, that's what makes it better in a way, because, yeah, the past few years have conditioned me to just ignore what those numbers and symbols say in the top right and just try and divine that through other means.
Well, let's not ignore that when we talk about the fact that you can micromancer for some of these.
Yeah, so that is the whole joke there, as it turns out. And I don't know how much of a, you know, plant this was many years in advance, you know, and eventually we're finding that payoff. But as far as we know, there's nothing which enables, like, a spell seeker ephemerate style chain. You have to jump through a lot more hoops with a lot more mana to do anything like that with Micromancer here. But yeah, I mean, any effect like that, and that is the kind of thing which nominally you get more access to as formats get larger, although in practice it basically is literally spell seeker once you get to Legacy. But yeah, things that care about mana cost in the other direction, like, yeah, you can now fill your deck with 1 drops and 2 drops, which you can cast before value as 5 drops and 6 drops down the line.
Yeah, maybe when you're building your Lurrus deck, you can include 1-cost spells that meet the... Wait, that's not how the restriction works. are there any of these that don't feel like they're overcosted by one? Because that has been my general first read of most of these, is that, like, I guess Insatiable Avarice is, like, vaguely the correct cost for black, 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 target player draws 3 and loses 3. But also, I don't think Painful Truths is a playable Magic card in this year, so, like, adding a weirdo Vampiric Tutor kicker to it doesn't really help.
The only one I've been impressed by so far is 3 Steps Ahead. So this is a blue instant with Spree, of course, and the additional costs are as follows. 1 and a blue, counter-target spell, so that is just cancel, that mode. Additional 3 gets you create a token copy of an artifact or a creature you control, and then additional cost of 2 gets you draw 2 cards and then discard a card. So in that same mold as stuff like Supreme Will, Confounding Riddle, are these modal cards, as some people might call them for some reason. And I think it's pretty good for what it is. Like, yeah, sometimes you're never pleased to just be casting the card cancel, but you're never actually doing that. You always have the option of doing that effectively. And the fact that you can just cash this in to sift through a few cards, or the token mode is the one that actually, like, if there's something that moves this from just cool modal card, you play 1 or 2 copies in some blue decks, to, oh, this is actually a centerpiece of a deck and a card that you're excited to see, is going to be exploiting that mode in a clever way. And so, yeah, that's when you start scanning the card pool for any, like, Goldspan Dragon style equivalents, or just things you can do with this where it, like, scales out of proportion very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me of Sublime Epiphany, but with a buyout clause and a little less... Like, you probably didn't need to get the full, like, 5 effective value out of that card, right? If you just got the 2 that you wanted, it was pretty good, and this has the cancel buyout. So yeah, it's pretty powerful. Also, like, the fact that it can backdoor into a catalog if you end up in a spot where cancel isn't good isn't that bad. Yeah, I mean, I can see this card being good. I think that it's going to be harder to build a deck that wants to cancel that also ends up in a spot where the create a token thing matters a lot. But at the same time, any game where you use that mode, you win the game on the spot, basically. So it's fine. I'm like vaguely interested in Final Showdown just as like instant speed wrath. And like the context of that in a standard format where it feels like a lot of the issue with non-Sunfall Wrath is that you get punished on the way back a lot. But I also don't think there's a lot of room for 3 white wrath in this format.
Yeah, I mean, I know the Saffron Olives of the world love to say that, oh, there are more wraths in standard than creatures these days. And however true that might be, most of those wraths just aren't playable at all. And farewell, you know, the bete noir of like, every commander player near you. That one shows up as like a one of in some control decks sometimes. And that one shows up because it hits everything. Planeswalkers aside, but for the most part, it hits everything. And that's why you play it. That's the joke. Whereas this one, it's like, okay, I mean, we're casting Route, which wasn't that good 20 years ago and isn't that great now.
Yeah, I don't think the other abilities on this card are going to matter a ton. I guess maybe, like, I don't know, at the point that you're costing 7 to, like, destroy all creatures, including the indestructible ones, and not give your opponent any death triggers, like, that's just, like, magical fantasy land mode on instant speed Wrath. Like, we saw, what was it, Faded Retribution years ago, and that was never good enough, and, like, that would be the same thing. So I'm kind of off that.
Yeah, so this mechanic, my verdict is a perfectly serviceable mechanic, but nothing really original or particularly inspiring about it, and it is literally just reading items off a menu. So I will be doing that, I'm sure, but won't have any fun tales to tell about it. Let's get into some of the standout cards and characters of the set. So we do, thanks to the whole weirdness around the first Aftermath flopping so badly that the planned Aftermath set for this one had to be folded into the main set, we do actually have 2 Planeswalkers here for the first time in quite a while, purely by accident. And so we've kind of alighted on the Jace and poo-pooed the big dreams that people have of it with Valkyrie and so on. Don't think we need to spend too much more time there. Let's talk about the Oko, though, because this one, it's not Broko, it doesn't hold a candle to the OG, and thank God for that, but it is still a pretty intriguing card, I think.
I think that in a world of, like, Rafine, Sentinel of the Nameless City, Preacher being the things that attack it, I'm a little skeptical of that. But at the same time, like, anytime your Oko just lands uncontested, makes a 3-3, and then the next turn becomes a Hexproof 3-3, makes another 3-3 and cracks in, your opponent just dies on the spot, it feels like. Like, that is so much power. Like, they're taking 6 damage, facing down 9 the next turn. That's really aggressive for a 4-drop Planeswalker. On top of all the other things you do with, like, looting away cards, and I guess I don't really want to, I don't think the ultimate matters, but, like, just, like, it's a lot of raw power and resource movement if the card survives.
Yeah, it feels very flippant to say, oh, this card is good when you're ahead, like every Planeswalker, but this one specifically, where if you, the turn you play it, have a relevant thing to copy, which, if Oko itself can't attack, is not that easy, but that's part of the charm of the card, I think, is, yeah, if you're copying, like, your Preacher with a Schism the following turn, and then attacking with both Preachers, okay, great, thumbs up. But also, if there's some, you know, weirdo creature with an activated ability, or some triggered ability where Oko becomes a copy of it, and now you have 2 of that, and you can, like, leverage that in some way, that's kind of neat as well. So yeah, I think you, again, no points for saying you want to pair this with good creatures, but the definition of what a good creature is it's pretty, it allows a lot of creativity there, I think. And yeah, it's bad with legends because you only get to keep one unless that's the entire point. And so you're like legend drawing your own Slowgurk or something, or your own thing that has a die trigger, or I don't know. You can find weirdo uses for this card. And to me, that's what I want my Planeswalkers to do, because that old model back in the day of, oh, well, you can +1 to draw a card and then you can -3 to kill something and you're already falling asleep. I like that with this card, you kind of can do that. Like, you can play the just classic protect the queen, protect the king, planeswalker game, but you can also try and do some, like, freaky shit on the side of it, too.
Is there, like, a haste or pseudo-haste creature that you're interested in copying with this, that you are, like, curving into it with, that would make the beginning of combat on the first turn trigger let you effectively double, like, you get your activation and then effectively another effect out of it? Because that feels like the spot where this card just goes from, like, potentially powerful to absolutely cracked.
Yeah, that's a good question. And so, yeah, that's another Scryfall search you have to do of what are the good, like, three drops with haste in Standard. Or you can flip it the other way. Is if you can make sure that your Oko survives a turn, then if you play some 5-drop, you effectively get a copy of that 5-drop that has haste when Oko becomes a copy of it. So that can just be something that has haste organically. So if you print Ghostbound Dragon, here's hoping, then you would just have two Ghostbound Dragons. But if it's... yeah, what are these creatures that's like, when this ETBs or attacks do a thing, which is a common template nowadays, where you get the actual card getting the trigger when it ETBs, and then, oh, suddenly I have another copy of it via Oko that can also just attack, along with, you know, the 3-3 that I made last turn or whatever. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways to, if you get a turn of reprieve with this card, to just completely snowball the game out of control. And so you can almost build your deck towards that play pattern now. Like, you know, making sure you make some trade with removal on their creature, which normally wouldn't be that appealing, but it is now because it just gives you another turn with Oko. So yeah, there's a lot to work for here, and I like that a lot.
Yeah, the problem I'm running into doing this gather or Scryfall search is that every single creature with haste is also a legend, and so that's a slight problem.
Yes. Let's touch on that theme, because this is a legend-themed set, as they all tend to be these days, and I'm told there is some, like, actual flavor tie-in where all of them end up on this, like, weirdo plane for whatever reason. But the upshot of it is there are a lot of distinct legends in the set, including some which normally you think would be earmarked for the commander decks. And when we get to our dishonorable mentions, certainly you'll see what we mean there. But, yeah, there's a lot of stuff which either calls out legendary creatures. There's the whole cycle of X joins up enchantments based around that theme. And then there's a lot of good legends themselves. So let's dive into some of those.
Yeah, let's just start with Tiny Bones, because I think that is the flashiest one of the set, and also the character that people love the most, and also just, like, an interesting card to analyze. This is the... it was previewed all the way back in Chicago. Black 1-1 Death Touch. Whenever it deals combat damage to a player, you can cast a non-land permanent from that player's graveyard and play that with mana of any type. This card reads like Roggevon, but it's like the weirdest reversed Roggevon of all time, where, like, you get max punished for trying to block it, because any time that you play a blocker into this and then they kill it, you have put a card in your graveyard that they could recast. And also, like, the fact that it has Death Touch means that you're, like, in this bind of, if your opponent plays Tiny Bones and you play, like, a random Esper Sentinel style thing to block it, and then they cut down that and then cast it from your graveyard, you die, like, the game is over. And if they play a big thing, like, you're getting the bad end of that trade. It's very weird that, like, the card reads so threatening, and the best thing you can do about it is not really pay attention to it and just, like, take other game actions that don't really invoke anything it's doing. As much as I talked about that with Crimes, where, like, you don't want to be reliant on what your opponent is doing in order for them to matter, I think this card is, like, the epitome of that. So I think that more than anything else about the card, that's the biggest problem with it, is that, like, your opponent can just decide to not play the Tiny Bones game, at which point it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, I guess there is some of the Young Wolf dynamic too, where if your plan is blocking Roggevon or blocking Tiny Bones, you really have to mean it. Like, just deploying one thing and crossing your fingers that they can't sort it out of the way, that doesn't really work. Whereas if you have one card that makes multiple blockers or is, like, prohibitively tough for them to remove, that now you're talking. So, like, Resolute Reinforcements out of Convoke, I think, would be the perfect example there. Although, that's another card which, like, if they ever get to connect and steal your Resolute Reinforcements, just given what your deck does, that's a pretty big swing. Given how the black midrange decks are set up in Standard right now, at least in the first few turns, if you're trying to do that sequence of you play a blocker, I kill it and hit you and connect, and then I cast your thing, the most likely blocker for a turn on Tiny Bones is their turn on Tiny Bones, which then you get no benefit from trying to recast. So there's another weird angle there where, like, the best card against Tiny Bones is itself.
That is weird and not something I had considered. That is really weird.
Yeah, but it does really throw into focus just the importance of your mana curve in Standard as well. So let's say you're on the play with your Dimir deck or your Esper deck or something. You play your Tiny Bones, they play a tap land. You play a land, you pass with two mana open. They play their, whatever their two drop is, right? Their Denik, their Ledger Shredder, their God knows what. You Mage Disappear it, you cut it down, you cast Go for the Throat, you untap and you cast that again. The game isn't over, but like you're very far ahead. And sometimes that's just unavoidable, right? But there's also stuff like, you know, Flash, anything with Flash gets better because now if you cast it on their end step, they kill it, they have to wait another turn cycle, another attack before they can maybe try and steal it from your yard again. Or if you're trying to block the Tiny Bones, then they have to commit the mana for that in combat, which means maybe they can't cast the thing even if they do kill it. So the like back and forth of how you use your mana every turn, how you sequence your one drops and your two drops, who's on the play versus the draw. Like, if you've played any of these mid-range mirrors in Standard, you know that that matters, but this makes it matter in a whole new way, perhaps. The cards that traditionally have been good in the black mirrors are good against Tiny Bones. So Wedding Announcement, for example. Don't know if that's going to stick around as like the go-to mid-range mirror breaker, but that card is pretty nice against Tiny Bones, unless they find a way to make you discard it or counter it or something. And then that gets kind of scary because it's probably pretty damn good against you too.
Yeah, I mean, you said this about play draw, but hypothesizing all these like really blowout scenarios, like I don't think this card creates any of those on the draw ever. Like, even just the like cut down versus novice inspector basic one is just completely flipped when you're on the draw to the extent that Tiny Bones will never ever connect.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to join up with Tiny Bones as his rare enchantment would have you do. So this is black for an enchantment, and when another legendary creature ETBs, target player mills a card and loses a life, and then
ETB, any number of players discard a card?
Yes, there we go. So this is an odd duck. I'm not sure exactly what you're meant to do with this, but I'm sure there's some, you know, loop where this is now like the third card that enables it, or at least makes it a lot more efficient. You mentioned Kethis in the notes here, which I hadn't even considered that. I'm sorry, Lee. But yeah, I mean, as most things do, it's very good with Kethis, but I'm sure there's other stuff which, given enough cheap legends, which that might be the sticking point, honestly. If you can find enough, then this is also very cheap and also a good enabler for whatever you're doing.
Yeah, the problem with this card is that it makes you lose life if you mill yourself, so there's a natural cap on the absolute bullshit you can do with it. But it is very interesting that you can do a little bit of bullshit with it, and then also, like, it's relatively subsidized and is also a weird win condition if you, like, use it to get going in a way that is, you with Kethis, presumably, you don't need this to be the card that mills your last 40 cards, but if you use it to mill your first 15, you are in a spot that is a lot better than if you didn't have it.
Yeah, I think at first, if you're doing the Greg Hatch surfing the wave style thing, where you don't have the loop set up, but this helps you converge towards the point where your loop will be set up by something else, then that's not a bad return for a single mana. I almost wonder if this is a good hopeless nightmare for the people who want that kind of thing for some kind of bargain deck, although I don't know how they're getting to enough legends that you care about the other side of this, and Hopeless Nightmare isn't just better at that point.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you want 5+ Hopeless Nightmares. Like, there could be value in having that many of that effect. Mm-hmm. I think the card, maybe you want this with another legend from the set, which is Satoru. This is the blue-black 2/3 with Menace, and whenever this or one or more other non-token creatures enter the battlefield you control, if they were not cast or no mana was spent to cast them, draw a card, which is like this weird unearth payoff. It is an absurdly weird card where, like, I don't actually know whether you're intended to play this card with a large number of Ornithopters, or like you're supposed to be blinking things with it, or you're supposed to be like casting Gruesome Menagerie and getting this and two other things back. Like, there's a lot of weird stuff you can do with this card to draw a large number of cards, but it is a very powerful engine.
Yeah, this is a Commander-ass line of text. This is the kind of thing I mean when I say that, you know, 30% of any Commander set is legends with incredibly obscure and specific requirements, which, if you know you can cast them repeatedly every single game, you can build a whole deck around that. in a 60-card format where you have no such guarantee, it becomes a little bit harder. That said, I think this is on the very positive end of that spectrum, where this is a really inventive way to tie together, without explicitly come out, a lot of, you know, disparate themes. So you can do the blink stuff with this, as you said, reanimation. It's a ninjutsu synergy card without mentioning the word ninja, which feels very flavorful in its own right. And then also, for some reason, yeah, this is the second Pure Steel Paladin that your Cheerios deck always wanted.
Yeah, again, very bizarre card that like, similar to how crime interacts with, like, 20 million things, this does that as well, and I don't think I'm hopeful for it, because there's, like, this weird gap where, like, as soon as it hits a larger format, you run into this problem where, like, it says draw a card, which is currently illegal, because the other card that costs two and is black and a creature puts a stop to that. But maybe I'll be proven wrong.
Yeah, I've seen people mention this in the context of the blue-black Scaminator deck in Legacy, where you already wanted a card that was both blue and black for your Force of Will over here and your Grief over here, and people are playing stuff like Wail of the Forgotten, just these heinously bad Dimir cards just to bridge that divide. Until Psychic Krog gets printed 2 months from now, this is probably the best in show until then. And yeah, it even has synergies with, you know, you play this, let's say you play this, it gets killed. Next turn you reanimate it, you draw a card, you evoke your Grief, you draw a card, and even then you've got a pretty sick return on it. And yeah, that, if you want to be more ambitious and build a bad deck but a very fun deck around it, then yeah, the sky really is the limit.
Yeah, okay. Shout out to the next legend on the list. Let's go graveyard-based. Honest Rutstein. This is a card that just is, like, weirdly efficient. This is the 1BG 3/2 EDB return a creature from your graveyard to your hand, and also your creatures cost one less to play. It's, like, a random build-around uncommon, but, like, it's a lot of... I don't know why my Eternal Witness is also a cost reducer. It's just a very weird amount of powerful text to put on a card.
Yeah, one issue with Gravediggers as a whole is it's easy to get choked out by the same things that are forcing you to cast a Gravedigger in the first place. So, like, you play the 2-drop that you really need to survive. They kill it, they keep applying pressure, keep developing that board. You play your Gravedigger, you get it back, and you've even got this other game piece to go along with it, but then you have to wait a whole other turn to then recast the thing, and then you might just be dead by that point. Whereas with Rutstein, it has this inbuilt mitigation against that, where it's a lot easier to turn four, you play this, you get back your 2-drop, you cast your 2-drop, still vulnerable to them removing it with the ETB trigger on the stack there, but so it goes. And yeah, it's a lot easier to chain this into something else, or to chain this into other copies of itself, because I think the one of the best things to return with an Honest Rutstein is the first Honest Rutstein, and they loop each other relatively efficiently. So yeah, in some kind of, like, you know, Slowgurk relic deck, or some kind of Insidious Roots deck, right, you loop two copies of this, you're paying black green for a root trigger and so much more every time. Anything that cares about creatures shuffling between zones, just two Rutstein's is a pretty decent way to do that.
Yeah, I had not considered the multiples with Insidious Roots angles. That is, that's Sprout Swarm levels of nonsense going on there, because every turn you're generating more mana for the future copies. And I guess it's not really Sprout Swarm, because they die before you really get to the point that you're, like, trying to calculate how to make the seventh token in a turn.
Yes, and then even in something like a good, honest Golgari midrange deck, there are so many good threes that the bar is so high, but the idea of, given that so many of them are high impact, like, yeah, they have to kill your Deep Cavern Bat, turn four, you play Rutstein, you get back your bat, cast your bat for one mana, take their next thing, like, and you can do that with your Sharp-Eyed Rookie, with Mosswood Red Knight, with, like, any of the single generic mana, single color mana, high impact 2-drops, and this could even extend to some Sultai deck, right? Like, maybe you're really leaning hard on your Rona or Nathan's card or whatever in the Sultai colors, and this is a good way to answer the question of, well, what do I do if they just cast a card down or something?
Yeah, I think you also need some adjacent graveyard engine to make that, like, you know, you don't want this to be your resilience to cut down and not have it do things on its own, but, like, when you get to the, like, Slowgurk is a perfect example where it's like, well, my Slowgurk deck is probably self-milling, so this is both a way to, like, if my Slowgurk somehow miraculously makes its way to the graveyard, which is actually impossible, but if it does end up there, whether I did it or my opponent did it, this is how I reaccess it.
Yeah. And then if you're aiming higher, sometimes even if there's nothing to dig out of the grave, maybe you just cast this on turn three, like you want to be using your mana, and that means that next turn you can double spell, you can cast a five drop a turn ahead of schedule. So yeah, I think really impressive card, which you're going to need to find an exact home for it. Like, for as much as I have dreams of, you know, those bat sequences or whatever, don't think it's going to slot into stock Golgari or whatever. But I think once you find a good home for it, like, this will be a real workhorse there.
Yeah, I don't have a good mental model for how good that cost reduction ability is, because you're describing this and I'm like, how often did Duskwatch Recruiter flip, and like, how many of those games did I win because my opponent just didn't play a spell on turn two and then they died? Maybe, I don't know if I'm over or undervaluing it, but it might just be like a really busted line of text to begin with.
Yeah. One of the big idiots you might want to ramp into here, Body Power Clearcutter. So this is a whole lot of stuff. This is, if you ask ChatGPT to generate a Simic legend for you, this is about what it would come out with.
This card is very weird to me. This was the point where I realized, had this long period in the game where they printed Titans, and they're like, maybe that was a bit much, and now this is just like, yo, this is a Titan, and we're just gonna give it to you, and like, I don't know, have fun. It's very jarring for people who, like, live through mid-2010s design to see this. At the same time, I don't even think it's that busted, because I think the gap between, like, a 6-mana card like this and a 7 like Atraxa is relatively small, and the sweeping effect of Atraxa is, it feels a little bigger. But maybe I'm just, like, underestimating how much, probably, like, this is 12 power on ETB, because it's a 6-5 reach that makes a blue ox that is power equal to the number of land you control, and then, like, I guess technically if you had another creature, you would attack and then draw a card on the spot too, but, like, I think the big thing it offers is that it's approximately a billion power for 6 mana.
Yeah, this is, you could try and compare it to, like, Gruff Triplets or whatever. This kind of thing is not totally new, but that template of when there's ETBs or attacks is pretty common these days, and it is very Titan-esque. In some cases, like, a very explicit callback. In other cases, like, it feels like it's just kind of grafted on. But here, even if one half of this dies, it feels like you got a good exchange there, right? So Bonnie dies, you have at least a 6-6, probably going to be 7-7, 8-8, so on and so forth. The fact that it has reach, again, strangely relevant in this standard format in particular, in a way that it wouldn't be most of the time. So, yeah, this card it's a lot of stuff, but as you say, like, what does that accomplish? Because your domain deck is probably going bigger. Your analyst deck, it wants to be on plan in game one, but this might be the answer too. Well, what if they shut off my graveyard and I'm trying to do all this mopey stuff? Well, yeah, maybe you spend your 6 mana making, like, 12, 13 power and drawing a bunch of cards, and then, yeah, you'll figure something out.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, hear me out. So you sacrifice this, the ox, to the Gitrog, and then because you've, like, analyst the first time, the Gitrog sets you up for the next analyst, and then you get to do this again, and, like, that's how you actually get to know cards in deck somehow. I don't know. I'm not CFT Sock. I'm just saying that these two cards are really close to each other in the visual spoiler, and therefore I can see them both in the same deck and, I guess, do something stupid with the fact that I've resolved a 5-drop and a 6-drop.
Yes.
A 5-drop I do want to talk about in terms of a broken-ish engine is Rakdos the Muscle. This is 2 black-black-red for a 6-5 flying trample. Sack another creature. It gains indestructible until end of turn. Tap it. Activate only once each turn. And that once each turn is actually because its other ability is, whenever you sack a creature, exile cards equal to its mana value from the top of target player's library, and until your next end step, you may cast those cards. And I'm idly wondering how close this is to Korvold. I know everyone gets like, oh, it says target player, I can cast my opponent's cards, because, like, that's the thing everyone wants to do, but I would just assume that the thing I want to do with this is, like, sack a creature and then cast the top card of my library, like, every time I loop a Cauldron Familiar.
Yeah, I think this is more of a big thing that's hard to kill, especially if you're actually destroying it rather than exiling or whatever. The same way that something like an Immerstone Predator was back in the day. The Korvold thing, this is just a lot more inherently limited, where Korvold, like, usually what you were doing was you play Korvold, and then you it eats a land on the way out, that draws you a card, and then you stack all your treasures that you have with, you know, zero mana value, those draw you a card, and then you stack a food, also zero mana value, to your Cauldron Familiar to get that back, and you could basically take a bunch of these small game actions that all amount to a card, whereas Rakdos explicitly pushes you in the other direction. It wants you to sack one big thing for a big chunk of cards, then figure it out, and that's just a lot harder to do in the kind of decks that want either of these in the first place.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. The fact that it's effectively creatures only and non-token is probably enough of a gap that it's not worth it. But it feels like non-token because of the mana value thing. But it feels like it's at least in the right ballpark. Maybe let's flip to the other side of the spectrum to close out on the legends here with Bristly Bill. This is the one in a green. Let's pretend that Hardened Scales is playable in Pioneer. Legendary creature, plant druid. Let's have a discussion about how plants are sentient on this plane, but they didn't. I don't really know. We're fine. Landfall, whenever land ETBs under your control, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature, and then 3 green, double the number of +1/+1 counters on each creature you control. Is, like, how much does the spread of, like, this puts counters on your creatures in whatever way you want versus, like, Vinelash or Kudzu has not aged well into 2024. Like, how big a difference does that make?
Like, the issue with something like a Pioneer Scales deck has never been, do I have ways to stack up a bunch of counters quickly? It's that's all I'm doing. And so it really needs... Walking Bliss is a lot to ask for, but something in that vein, and unless you're doing some weird, you know, Soul Cauldron Thrill Seeker style thing, all you're doing is just making some big idiots, and a lot of decks are good at swatting away your big idiots. So this is a good small idiot, but I don't think it really changes the terms of engagement there.
Yeah, that's kind of how I vaguely feel about it. Should we move along from Legends, or are there any more that you want to touch on before we get to, I guess, random other cards?
Yeah, let's talk about the sandworms that we're going to find here. So, Colossal Rattleworm, this is...
It's a 2GG 6/5 trample, has flash as long as you control a desert, and then one in a green, exile it from your graveyard, search your library for a desert card, put it onto the battlefield, tap, and then shuffle.
Depending on how you're wired, your mind might immediately jump to, oh, I get to flashback a Rampant Growth out of my graveyard for free, and... Sam Black just wordlessly posted this alongside Insidious Roots on Twitter, which, you know, that's one side of the equation. The other one is, this is a lot of beef for 4 mana, even if you don't meet the desert conditions. So it's a sign of just how much the obligatory 5/5 for 4 mana in green in every set, like the Deadbridge Goliaths of the world, those have come a long way, and this one is, you know, one of the best of those we've ever seen. I don't know how far that even gets you at all. Like, is the issue there one of rate, or is it just fundamentally this is trying to do the wrong thing and it doesn't matter how well you do it in the end?
I think that the card that you brought up that I had completely forgotten about, and that states exactly how, like, out of range this is Woodland Wanderer, which was a card printed, like, almost a decade ago now and is largely the same parameters as, like, oh, it's a big 6-power vigilance trample giant idiot, and like it just doesn't matter. I expect it's a lot of the same on this card, and it's just a case of like this is the rate you can get away with printing that makes people look at it and say, oh shit, before they realize that it just doesn't actually matter.
I think, yeah, the issue with that class of card is very easily invalidated by some kind of interactive effect. So in Wanderer's case, right, Reflector Mage basically ban the card for as long as they were in standard together. Like your Teferi Time Raveler, you know, any big thing that didn't leave something behind or do something when it ETB'd, you could not play a card like that in the face of Teferi or Vapor Snag, to use a cheaper example too. Like cards like that, if there's some kind of bad lineup in that way in the format, they just vanish from existence entirely. And maybe the success of Shieldred over the past few years is proof that given enough support, cards like that can actually do things still in contemporary Magic, and this is on the right side of that line, I think. If no other reason, then if they do kill it somehow, well, yeah, you just get another kind of a good buyout effect on the back end too.
Yeah, I think that some of it also may just be like color, because I don't think this card is that far off of like Archfiend of the Dross and its actual effect on the game, but the problem is that green is not capable of reducing the game to a state where it matters, just like, we have both been left with a single card and my card is the immediate highest quality for the cost and like effect, like per card effectiveness that I can produce. Whereas green is just like, I have no way to stop my opponent from doing things, so therefore I have to do something bigger when I get to 4 or 5 mana.
Yeah, there's also green is maybe the worst color of making use of the flash component there. Nightbook Ambusher history aside, but I could see this in a deck which is a lot better at leveraging that. The mana base there gets funky, but also in part because of the set, the mana in Standard is better than it basically ever has been, so maybe you've just figured it out.
Well, they haven't. We didn't really talk about deserts as a mechanic, and I think that's because the 11 deserts that have been previewed so far are just not cards that I want to put in my deck. I mean, maybe the colorless bounce land is the right range for a constructed level card, but correct. I don't want ETB tap duel that does a damage to my opponent in my deck. So that kind of, like, at least with what we've seen so far, relegates this card to, like, Pioneer, at which point, yeah, I can put Haship Oasis and Scavenger Ground in my deck, but I don't really want a 6/5 flash in Pioneer because that's just not what the format's about. Like, it's just a worse Asika's Chariot or whatever, because that actually is a card that is a bunch of power and value.
Yeah, I worry that the desert stuff will go the same way as Caves and Gates and everything of that nature, where just play a normal mana base and the good cards instead. You know, don't jump through a bunch of hoops for these cards that really aren't worth it. With Rattleworm, the fact that yeah, you don't get the flash unless you have the desert, but I think you can treat that as the cherry on top if you can unlock it. And if you can't, well, you still just have a good creature for 4 mana, which also, like the 2 mana mode from your graveyard, that's the real enticing thing to me, because you could have a deck which, in Pioneer, let's say, where you have that original pool of deserts too, you exile this from your graveyard, you find the Scavenger Grounds against your Phoenix opponent. You find just Hostile Desert, right, as a pretty good man land, honestly, in a deck that's milling itself a lot, which presumably you are to set this up. That's just an amazing rider to have on an otherwise good card. And it feels like you can consciously opt into like 2/3 of this card and still be pretty pleased with that deal.
When you do this from your graveyard and you get Arid Archway, it's basically a Cultivate. That is pretty messed up. And that's the bounce land desert where it's like,
yeah,
ETB tap for 2 colorless, pick up a land when it ETBs, and I guess surveil if you control another desert. But like the end effect of doing this is that like you have put Arid Archway, like a land that produces colorless, into play and then put a land into your hand. Like that is very powerful. And that might be what carries this card more than like anything else, is just like it is, if you jump through the hoop of getting it into your graveyard, one of the more powerful rampant growths that we've seen in recent years.
It is funny that even if you're not returning another desert with this to get the Surveil Barn, one of the things you're most likely to be returning instead is just an actual Surveil land from the most recent set.
Yes, that is true. Oh, and that's a way... Oh, gosh. When you spike your Rattleworm on with the Surveil land, game over.
Oh, dick. I mean, that's actually kind of messed up, right? Like, that can... You keep a hand which, okay, you play your Underground Mortuary. If you spike the Rattleworm, that changes, like, the entire rhythm of your development for the entire rest of the game. Like that. And it might even be, right, you spike the Rattleworm, turn 2, you exile it, and then turn 3, you just cast another one from your hand. Like, that's actually kind of fucked up.
Yeah, and also, like, I guess I assumed that it was a sorcery. It's just not a sorcery,
no,
exile.
No?
No. What the hell?
Yeah, this... And, like, they enable each other in that way, too, so... Yeah, it might be hard to get the flash organically, but if you have previously in the game discarded a Rattleworm and then use it, you have a desert now, and that one is all you need. So you might have 4 or 5 deserts in your deck, but you might still expect on turn 5 or 6, you're still going to have this this flash threat reliably.
That lines up pretty good, and maybe this is just like a weirdo graveyard card and not actually a random rate card. Do we want to talk about lands now or later?
Yeah, let's get them out of the way, because I had to think there was some rare cycle of lands coming in the set. And with what I was saying about the mana fixing in Standard being amazing, there was a caveat to that, which is if you are in enemy colors, the fixing is amazing. If you're trying to do any kind of remotely slower 2-color, 3-color thing that can afford a turn 1 tap land, your mana is phenomenal. Best it's ever been. if you're trying to be specifically an enemy color aggro deck, is going to be a struggle unless you have enough creature type batching that Cavern of Souls and Secluded Courtyard get you across the line. And there is one deck already which fits that description, and that is Boros Convoke, which, even if it gets no actual spells from the set, the fact that it got not just any land, but I was joking, yeah, they're just going to print Inspiring Vantage and Convoke will be broken. That's what they did, and now Convoke just got this gigantic upgrade.
I am, honestly, as much as people talk about that card, I'm almost most interested by the other white land, Concealed Courtyard. My big complaint about the Esper decks is you are a base white-black deck trying to play your spells on curve, and your lands just don't exist in a way that makes that relatively easy. And Concealed Courtyard makes the mana so much better for Bat into Ravine in ways that just are very hard to describe until you look at hands that include this freaking stupid Crimson Vow tapped land.
Shattered Sanctum, baby. You have like
two of those.
$30 worth, yeah.
Yeah, even... not anymore. Get out. Please leave my decks.
Yes, the songs in that card are plummeting as we speak. But even more ambitious openings like Tiny Bones into Genic or whatever, if you have like more of a Legends thing going on, like the mana actually kind of works out for stuff like that now in the way that it didn't before. So a lot of one drops on the table now in a way they weren't before. Some of the more demanding two drops to cast you can do now. And then those are the templates that we know about already. There might be... you know, is it aggro decks, for example, like based around, I don't know, pirates or spellslinger stuff or whatever that were just dead on arrival before because the mana simply didn't work and now it very much does. So that's going to be the wild card, I think, heading into the first few weeks of this standard, including at the PT, is there some, you know, is it a deck that got a big boost that no one even knew existed, wasn't on the radar before? Same thing for, I don't think there's really like an aggressive black-white deck that hasn't been mined in that way, but you never say never, right? Or maybe this lets you do some three-color aggro deck, right? Maybe the mana now for Mardu works properly, or I know there were lists of these Jeskai Convoke decks or these artifact decks which you kind of wanted the cheap white cards and the cheap blue cards and the cheap red cards, and maybe now you can just fudge that. If you have 12 fast lands and pain lands, then yeah, go off.
I mean, you're saying all this, and I'm just thinking, okay, so I'm just going to go Inspector into Bat into Ravine, and it's just all going to be good, and it's just all on the table, and my opponent's going to take 8,000 damage on turn 3 and die.
You can also do that, yes. So yeah, we've seen the lands before, we know how good they are, but certainly in the context of this standard, you're going to have a massive impact there as well. Moving back to cards that we are now just seeing for the first time here, one thing I do want to talk about, but there's not going to be another good place for it, is Larvaspur Boots. So this is the one drop equipment, which it costs one to equip, gives a creature +1/+0, and haste and ward 1, I believe. So the obvious application for this is as part of a self-contained Urza Saga package, where we're familiar with a lot of the Saga decks. They sneak in the one Shadow Spear so that their constructs can take over the game against other creature decks. And with the Boots, just having access to a Boots, the entire math around what kind of clock does Saga represent changes, because now the construct that gets baited on the way out with Saga, well, that now just gets to attack right now. So you're shaving at least a turn off that clock usually. And so certainly in a deck like Hammer, where you already have some interest in just a card like Larvaspur Boots as an equipment, and your constructs are massive anyway, and you're an equipment theme deck, like, okay, yeah, easy to slot one in there. But I wonder how far that goes. So if you are just an otherwise like creature agnostic Urza Saga deck, do you find room for the Boots as well as a Shadow Spear? Do they compete with each other? Like, I wonder how much purchase it actually finds just in completely different contexts.
Yeah, I think that this is like well-timed for Modern Horizons 3, a like drastic change in the scope of Urza Saga. I think that it's weirdly inverted, where the less your deck cares about other creatures, the more you specifically want this. Like, if I'm playing an Asmo deck and I'm just like, I'm just gonna Urza Saga out my opponents in the games where my deck is like, I'm trying to think of, like, I played against an Asmo Cookbook Saga Goryeo's Vengeance deck on Magic Online, and that feels like the exact deck where I'd want some Boots, where it's like, okay, I just want to like have Urza Saga be this standalone kill my opponent as fast as possible threat in a decent number of games.
Here's a thought that literally just occurred to me is I've been playing a lot of Elvish Reclaimer, Knight of the Reliquary decks that haven't Urza Saga in them in Legacy recently. Giving my Reclaimer or my Knight Haste, that sounds pretty appealing to me. I'm not going to lie.
Ooh, that is pretty nice. That is a weird like subset of tutors, but I guess at the point that you're like an amulet player, you're just kind of used to that being your entire existence, so carry on. Oh, wait. Oh, gosh. Did I just break it?
Okay. So I think in that context, normally if you're getting amulet instead, your Titan already has a route to be giving itself haste, but there might be lines where getting this instead frees you up to just fetch like a totally different pair of lands, which is going to be better, or it has the same thing where if you're trying to win with constructs in a fair game, then this makes that like meaningfully easier, and you can lean harder into that now. So maybe that's a thing.
Yeah, it is. It's just interesting is a different way to give your Titan haste that isn't necessarily amulet based. When your opponents are maniacs in Surgical Extraction, but yes. You know, whatever.
Secure a Tribe Scout gains haste. We're so back. Anyway.
Sure.
Moving on to one of the more mainstream standouts from this set, Aven Interrupter. I'll let you rattle off the text on this one, but this is in the vein of like the Spellqueller family of effects, which have a pretty good pedigree, but this has some pretty unique upsides there as well.
Yeah, one white, 2/2 flying flash, ETB, exile target spell, it becomes plotted, and your opponent's any spell your opponent casts from graveyard or exile costs 2 more to cast, so it's also in, like, the weird vein of the, like, elite spellbinder thing, where, like, you're breaking up how they pay the cost plus the 2. I think the most interesting part of this card, less than, like, the weirdo remand thing, is that the fact that it cuts off access to, like, the cast from exile parts of a lot of key combos. Like, it almost has this, like, Teferi feel to it, where, like, it does one thing on the card, but, like, in practice, it's actually more of the hate bear than, like, a bounce spell.
Yeah, and because plotting only works at sorcery speed, in the sense that you can only cast a plotted card during your own turn, if you plot their actual counterspell, for example, like, they're just never actually using that. Notable difference from a card like Spellqueller there, but if you try and win some stack fight with your Queller, that house of cards can still collapse at a moment's notice. With this card as well, like you don't have that pattern of, well, I almost need to invest other stuff into protecting that like Spellqueller style effect, because if I lose that, I lose everything. With this, you just get the whole thing up front and you feel good about it.
Yeah, and I guess another, like, weird thing about this card is that, like, I don't know why you would want to do it, but it can also, like, target your own spells in some weird situation. It can also target uncounterable spells and take care of those, at least for a turn. So it is a, like, weirdly good reaction to Supreme Verdict.
Is this where you, let's see, so you cast your Bramble Familiar, and then you use the Aven on it, and then can you replot it next turn having paid the tax as the adventure side?
I think that is working a lot. Like, I guess it's all playable cards, but it's working a lot to make a little. But yes, I think you can.
Yeah, I don't expect to actually be doing this, but it's cool that you can.
I think it is simultaneously, like, it's worse at doing the thing it says it does and better in every other way around that.
Yes. It would be remiss of us not to give an explicit segment to the first bounce land in the entire history of Pioneer here in Arid Archway. So we covered some of the applications when talking about the worm before, but just this card existing opens up a lot of interesting possibilities with, you know, cards like Spelunking and so on, first of all, but then just any of the stuff that tutors for lands in Pioneer before runs into the issue that there isn't really any good stuff to find, and this doesn't wholly address that issue by itself, but it does allow you to, for example, you know, you pick up a Baseju to reset it, get that back to your hand. Same thing goes for any of the other channel lands, or you can find stuff to do in that vein. There could be decks which, you know, you have exactly one archway somewhere, but just the mere presence of that opens up a ton of lines that were off the table before.
Does this card plus Lotus Field go off in a lot of spots that Lotus Field would, where, like, you can potentially bypass the whole problematic, like, do I need Thespian Stage in play for X amount of time thing? Or I guess maybe it's just too much of a constraint on the number of land you have on the battlefield, but I that feels like it is relatively close enough.
Yeah, I think you get the diminishing returns of the, like, bounce land slash sacrifice land cost, and also colorless is a lot worse than colored mana in the context of Lotus Field, especially if you're working towards some, like, emergent ultimatum style endgame. So I think probably not, but there could be a different call of, like, Lotus Field, bounce land, spelunking deck where, yeah, you get to use all parts of the proverbial bison there.
Yeah, that... Yeah, this card is powerful, and it existing in Pioneer is a pretty big deal. I think that does it for, like, the big deal cards. Are there any, like, weird corner case one-offs that you want to chuck in here at the end?
So there is a High Noon, which is simultaneously the best rule of law we've ever seen, and also just randomly merc something on its way out. So this is one and a white for an enchantment. Each player can only cast one spell per turn, and then it's either four in a red or five in a red. I think it's four in a red. You can sacrifice to just deal five to any target. So in the context of something like the Enigmatic Incarnation deck, this is a two drop that you can pod into a three, which is, you know, the usual sequence there. It is a good thing to find against, like, Phoenix or Lotus to shut down their game plan, and then going long against anything else, or sometimes against Phoenix too, yeah, you just pay five and you kill that thing and you feel pretty good about it.
It is weirdly bad with your own fires is my only thing.
It is, but you, I mean, to a point, yes, but you can also leverage the fact that fires is casting stuff for free, because that frees up your mana to sacrifice this, which then unlocks your other spells. So I don't know, you get to work yourself out of that knot in this elaborate way.
That's fair. I guess that's true. I have heard various low rumblings about this card in the white Lurrus decks in Vintage, where it's like a reasonable game one card that also is Lurrusable, but I think that's mostly just like Vintage players attempting to put any card in Spoiler Season into their deck and then having success, because, like, at some point the only thing that matters is that you've produced Moxen, but it's cool.
Yes, Lurrus is in fact good with cards. Congratulations. You check back in next set. Let's move on.
Well, yes. I have one card I want to talk about that is not good with Lurrus, and that's Ruthless Lawbringer.
Okay.
And it's not good with Lurrus because it costs one white black. This is the uncommon white-black, sort of like weirdly signpost card. It's a 3-2 ETB, sack another creature, and if you do, destroy target non-land permanent. This feels like it is a relatively powerful twist on the, like, Fleshbag Marauder archetype of card, where, like, it is any permanent. It's not, like, restricted in, like, these weird ways where you can't cast it because you don't have other creatures against a control deck. It, like, those cards are, like, at their best when they're also a sacrifice enabler, and this is doing a lot of that. I don't know. It just feels like it is a noticeable power-up from a lot of the previous iterations of that effect in a way I don't think we've seen.
I'm a bit gun-shy because I always overrate having access to these in the context of these creature toolbox decks. You know, I thought the, not Singling Spider, but some other word that starts with S, spider, would be really good in Yawgmoth, for example. Sky.
Oh, is this the Skyfisher spider, the one from War that was absolutely busted in Limited?
And absolutely unplayable in modern Yawgmoth, as it turns out. But yeah, so I know my own biases here, but I agree with you. This does. I'll file this one away for future reference. The only other card to call out quickly, I think, was, for good reasons here, Altec Matterweaver. This is the 2-and-a-white 2/4 that when you cast a creature, you can either make a 1/1 that's an artifact, or you can copy an artifact token already. Just a pretty nice self-contained engine, like decent body by itself. If you have a bunch of cheap creatures, you now kind of like double your return on those. So this doesn't go in the aggro deck Boros Convoke, but there could be some deck where, okay, I have a bunch of cheap one drops, maybe including Warden, which then wants other stuff that I can tap to it, and then, you know, that makes fueling other Convoke stuff pretty easy. Just a neat little trinket, a cool engine to build around. And then finally we come to the dishonorable mentions section of the show, the one that we've all been waiting for. And when I asked for your suggestions for how to fill this out, you had exactly one, and it was the same as mine, and from what I can gather, the same as basically everyone else's. So take it away on Riku, if you will.
This is a green, blue, red for a 3-3 legendary creature, human wizard. Whenever you cast a modal spell, choose up to X, where X is the number of times you chose a mode for that spell. I have to read the rest of this, don't I? Okay, exile the top card of your library. Until the end of your next end step, you may play it. Put a +1/+1 counter on Riku. It gains trample until end of turn. Create a 1/1 blue bird with flying. Okay, so let's rewind. Why are the, like, you have three modes, but they do, like, four things? I just, like, okay, let's just get back to the, like, what the hell is a modal spell? Like, there's nothing, modal is not a word that's existed before in Magic.
Yeah, so there is some of the breaking the fourth wall property to this, where it's something which is implicit on so many cards, including popular cards. Like, they know people love their charms, people love modal spells. We had this very intentional push when Arena emphasized best of one to encourage cards that you could main deck that had that flexibility in them, right? And so an example recently, which has really made waves everywhere, has been Pick Your Poison. So people love modal cards, but they don't love them as capital M, capital C modal cards. This isn't a theme that you build a deck around. These are just cards that you sprinkle in wherever else because they kind of fit with everything. And that's part of their charm, to, pun intended there. So to call it out in this ham-fisted way, it first invites the question, what is the modal card? And already people are identifying these really funny edge cases of things which you think would count but don't, and vice versa. You know, Siege of Strength, here's a classic, right? Your target creature gets +1/+1 until end of turn, and then you just repeat that line of text. So it's not really a modal card, but it's also not a modal card. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff like that, which, yeah, okay, you could just not be a brat and not ask those questions, but also, why does a card like this exist if not to get people asking exactly those questions? Like, that's... no one needs this, but you're saying that we want it, but do we? I don't know.
I just don't want it on a card that has so much text that it can't explain it, and it's also the only card that ever cared about it. Imagine if Oko, the original one, was the only card that made food ever, and you had to, like, find a food token to tell you what a food is. Like, that's the level of egregious this is to me. On that note, another thing to complain about. Oko is in these packs, not in Standard. But you could be the recipient of dying to Oko at the Pro Tour again.
Wait, the first one?
Wait, did you not know this?
Oh, dear God.
Oko. So the bonus sheet in this set, like, there's the. We'll get to the other problem here. So there's one of the many things that is in these packs, in the actual draftable packs, is that there's a bonus sheet slot, like every other bonus sheet, that is cards that commit crimes. So, like, the cards they have previewed so far are, like, Thoughtseize, Path to Exile, Dust Bowl, a crime against humanity, Crime Punishment, which half of it is a crime, weirdly, which is the part that says crime, which I guess makes sense, but punishment isn't a crime. Anyways, Grindstone, Mana Drain, which I will at least give the experience of, like, it is novel to get Mana Drained and Limited after 30 years, and then Oko, which, like, the Thief of Crowns, which, like, this is just not cool, right? Like, this is just not fun or interesting to have happen to you again. Like, the problem with Oko was that it was so unfun to play against that people, like, couldn't even stand it being a good card. So it has been removed from the game, and it keeps showing back up in, like, cubes, so you can keep experiencing the how unfun it is. And, like, I don't think enough time has passed to put Oko in a pack and have people be not like, what the fuck, why is this happening to me again?
Yeah,
And it's at normal mythic rare distribution, oh, which is, like...
Cool. So, I was gonna say, I don't know exactly all the different respective rarities of the multiple bonus sheets plural that we have in the play boosters for this set, but if it's on the level of the inventions or the expeditions or whatever, like, yeah, we've seen people get strip mined at the Pro Tour. Sam Black famously, like, the Wrath of God Pro Tour Arrow Devastation, like, stuff like that. If it's rare enough inherently, like, that is a moment, right, that you can appreciate. With this, if it's just on the level of any other mythic, it's, yeah, there's actually a somewhat decent chance that I just get Oko'd, and I have to live with that reality.
Yeah, it's bad. It's very bad. I don't like it. And on that subject of the invention thing, would you want to guess which cards in this set are in the packs at invention rarity? Not invention rarity, it's not that bad. But Which cards do you think they would want to insert into these packs at a rarity that is more extreme than a typical Mythic? At least according to everything that I've read and data from previous sets.
I'm going to rely on someone else to make a nice looking infographic to just absorb all of this knowledge without having to do anything.
Okay. So the answer is the Vault, or the Big Score, or the standard legal bonus cards. So this actually may be somehow worse than creating another Aftermath pack, because they have put them into the packs at, as far as I can tell, and as far as every piece of media they've released and everyone else can tell, the cards from the Big Score are going to be more rare than Mythic rares by like a factor of... I'm basing this off 17 land stats, where they're in there on the list as like Mythic rares on the list, which in MKM, that was... Let's see, the uncommons on the list are as rare as normal Mythic rares, and the Mythic rares are multiple times more rare than Mythic rares. So maybe they're just like all in there on the list at uncommon rarity, and they're effectively normal Mythics, and like this is solved. But if that is not the case, you potentially have a set of 40 ultra rares in standard that, like, if any of them ever becomes a thing, it just is a problem on like catastrophic levels.
Okay, so which of the cards we've talked about today are in the Vault and not in the normal set?
Exactly one, and that is Oltec Matter Weaver. But I could easily see... So this is Nexus of Becoming. This is the 6-mana artifact that, like, you draw a card on each of your combats, and then you can exile an artifact or creature from your hand and, like, make a copy of it. That's a golem being one of the things that hits. Like, just as, like, this is an engine that if I ever draw an Atraxa, kills them. There's also the Vaultborn Tyrant, which is the, like, 7-mana 6/6 trample that, like, whenever it or another creature that is big ETBs, you gain life, draw cards, and it also it, like, dies into a copy of itself if it's not a token already. Like, I really hope that the distribution model has accounted for that and made these, like, normal Mythic rarities, but if it hasn't, that is a fiasco.
Yeah, that... are they foil by default again as well? Are we going to have to relive that whole experience?
They are not.
Small mercies.
There's some, like... So the only thing that has actually, like, listed the real distributions is that there is one of these cards in 10% of collect... Or five... They do have multiple treatments in the collector's booster, but one in 10 collector boosters has one of these cards, effectively. And as a result, like, these individually will show up in, like... One of these will show up in one out of, like, every 300 collector boosters on each card.
Okay.
Is the read that I'm getting from the numbers they put out.
I'm hoping...
And then they're also in normal packs, but, like, yeah. As you process that, is there anything else about this set that you would like to file under Dishonor?
Well, yeehaw, motherfuckers. Let's call it there. That news has finished me, I think. We can come back to other previews, other results, and other such nonsense next week or at some later date, but I'm spent. I think that's finished me off.